Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS. We are Catholic Radio for the Christian community. And good morning and welcome to Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
And today, Chris, it's been a while, but it is always a treat. We just love having Joseph Pierce on with us. Joseph, the author of numerous acclaimed biographies of major Catholic literary figures. Joseph is a writer in residence and professor of literature at Ave Maria University in Florida. Editor-in-Chief of Ave Maria University Communications and Sapientia Press, as well as co-editor of the St. Austin Review, an international review of Christian culture, literature, and ideas published in England and here in the United States. We're going to be talking to Joseph today about his new book, The Quest for Shakespeare. Joseph, a pleasure to have you back. It's been far too long, my friend.
It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
I have to let everybody know, Joseph, that you don't have to be a fan of Shakespeare to appreciate this book. If you love a good detective novel, if you love good biographies, if you love the quest for the unknown, and even if you're a lawyer, you would love this book.
Yeah, it is. It is like a detective story. I think I allude to that fact in the opening chapter. You know, I obviously do love Shakespeare, but the times in which Shakespeare living, the persecution, the imprisonment, the executions, the spies, I mean, it is the stuff of great fiction, except, of course, we're dealing with great and largely unknown facts.
It's fascinating how you went about just putting the pieces of Shakespeare's life together. And of course, when you did that, you had to start at the very beginning. Of course, we have to speak of his parents. And I think one of the heroes in this book is William Shakespeare's father.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I began as a skeptic. You know, I had friends who were telling me that Shakespeare was a Catholic. And I was saying, you know, we can see Catholicism in the plays, but, you know, we have to be careful of not just reading into the plays what we want to see. And there just isn't enough evidence that Shakespeare was a Catholic, so we have to be careful. But bit by bit by bit, you know, the evidence started to come to me, and, you know, in the end, you sort of a threshold is reached where you think, well, hang on for a second. There might be something in this. And then I started looking. And, of course, the evidence from Shakespeare's own parents, and particularly his father, the spiritual wooden testament that was discovered, hidden in the rafters of his house. You talk about it being a detective story. I mean, this document is discovered, concealed in the roof of the Shakespeare family home 150 years after Shakespeare's death. And the implications and ramifications of that discovery. And, of course, the fact that we know that Shakespeare's father was fined for being a defiant Catholic in 1592. And we know also that, you know, he was forced to retire from politics because of his Catholicism. I mean, all of these facts, you know, are verifiable and documented. This is the marvelous thing about this.
It is. I found what was so great about this book was also it was an essential history lesson in the life of a community in England during the time of Elizabeth that we don't hear very much about. It's really kind of a squashed portion of history, wouldn't you agree?
Well, absolutely. See, one thing that's often said, of course, and it's true, is that history is written by the victors.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems that English history has had to face is that it was rewritten as propaganda by the Protestant victors of the Reformation. And it's taken some really diligent research by historians over the last 200 years to show the falsehood of that. And, you know, we know from historians such as Lingard and Hilaire Belloc, and more recently Eamon Duffy, that England did not convert to Protestantism joyfully and willingly, but it was forced upon the English people by Henry VIII and his cohorts and henchmen. And many parts of England held out defiantly for their Catholic faith in the midst of great persecution. And one of the towns where the majority of the people remained Catholic right up to well into Queen Elizabeth's reign, well into the life of William Shakespeare, was Stratford-upon-Avon, where William Shakespeare was born, where we now know that the majority of the population remain defiant Catholics at a time when Catholicism was illegal.
Yeah, it is fascinating reading once again about his father. At least I hadn't heard very much about him until I read your book, and the role he played within that city and the influence not only of him but many other Catholics who just quietly continued to practice their faith, but had to do it under such great persecution.
Absolutely. I mean, a parallel situation that maybe, you know, some of your listeners may know is the play in the film A Man Four Seasons, and the situation that St. Thomas More found himself in. You know, he didn't want to break the law. He didn't want to become a martyr for the Catholic faith. He wanted to live peacefully as far as his conscience would allow. And that's exactly the situation that we find John Shakespeare, Shakespeare's father, in, and indeed William Shakespeare in his own life. These are people that, you know, don't have a death wish. They don't want to be martyred for the Catholic faith, but they do want to stand by their Catholic conscience, and they do so heroically. And in the case of John Shakespeare, it costs him his career, it costs him a huge sum in fines, and it costs him a great deal of fear to the extent that, as we see, he had to hide that spiritual will and testament in the roof of his own house for fear that if it was discovered, it could lead to him being thrown in prison. You know, so these were scary times in which someone's Catholic faith cost them dearly if they were going to be true to their conscience.
You're listening to Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and Chris McGregor here on Spirit Catholic Radio KVSS, talking this morning with Joseph Pierce. His latest book, The Quest for Shakespeare.
What I also loved, again, was the detective work on your part, Joseph, that brought to life this community in Stratford of Avon, that the potential of its interaction with others of great Catholic note, the great martyrs like Edmund Campion.
Yes, I mean, there's good evidence that Shakespeare, as a young man, may have served as a schoolmaster in a wealthy Catholic reticent home in Lancashire. And if he had served there, and there's a whole chapter on this in my book, giving the evidence for it, but if he had served there, then we know that Edmund Campion, the Jesuit martyr, was staying in the area and had visited the actual house that Shakespeare was living in at the time that Shakespeare was there. So there's this a beguiling possibility that the young William Shakespeare would have known the Jesuit martyr Edmund Campion. But there's even stronger evidence that once Shakespeare had come to London and was making his name as a playwright, that he knew the Jesuit martyr St. Robert Southwell, who was a great poet as well as being obviously a great Catholic priest and ultimately a martyr. And there's very strong evidence that Shakespeare knew Robert Southwell. And there's also strong evidence that Shakespeare knew another martyr who was actually went to the same school as Shakespeare in Stratford-upon-Avon, Thomas Dibdale, who went on to be martyred for his Catholic faith and subsequently beatified by the Church. So all of these connections with these heroic saints and martyrs with Shakespeare's own life, I map out showing the documentary evidence in the book.
You know, another area that is rather perplexing for history is his relationship with his wife, Anne. The ambiguity about whether or not they were married prior to the conception of their children, to the how they were married, if they were married in the Anglican Church. And you get pretty strong evidence that actually their marriage, unusual for that place and time, that they would choose to go somewhere where there was an Anglican priest who was actually a Roman Catholic priest.
Right. Basically, after the death of Edward VI, Henry VIII's son, Mary Tudor became Queen of England, and she tried to turn England back to a Catholic country. So that the priests that were ordained under Queen Mary were obviously Catholic priests, and they were called the Marian priests, in other words, ordained under Queen Mary. Mm-hmm. And Shakespeare and his bride-to-be, Anne Hathaway, went to great length to not be married in their local parish church, which is what the law stipulated they had to do, mm-hmm. because the local parish vicar there was a staunch Protestant who had alienated himself from the Catholics of Stratford-upon-Avon, including Shakespeare's own family. And instead, they went to a nearby parish where there was this Marian priest who was known to be sympathetic to the old religion, and they chose at great trouble to themselves to go through the formalities necessary to be allowed to do this. they chose to be married by him rather than by the Protestant local vicar, which, again, it just serves as further evidence of Shakespeare's own Catholicism.
The reason why this discussion is so very important is not just to say that William Shakespeare, he was either a Protestant or a Catholic, but if we understand Shakespeare truly is a Catholic, it helps shed light on, if not the greatest playwright, poet of history, because it has influenced the dimensions of the characters of his play, why they are so timely, why it plays out, and why it still speaks to us today.
Absolutely, and I'm actually working, I'm working on a follow-up book looking at the evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism in the plays. We see it in abundance. And the crucial thing from an evangelizing perspective, you know, this cultural evangelization that comes from this, if we can show convincingly, which we certainly can, both as regards to historical evidence from Shakespeare's life and from the textual evidence from the plays, that Shakespeare was a believing Catholic, it forces the academy throughout the whole world to put Catholicism back on the map, back on the menu, back within the academy, because in order to understand Shakespeare, we have to understand Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
And the powerful impact of that on the culture cannot really be overstated. Shakespeare, you know, is a major force in the efforts to culturally re-evangelize our culture to Catholicism again. So, you know, this is not of merely academic interest. It actually has major practical ramifications.
Now, the question becomes for so many people that if he was a Catholic as a young man, maybe he had to renounce that in order to be able to survive in Elizabeth's court. And yet, as you point out, he, along with William Byrd, a great composer, if you've never listened to Byrd's music, you really owe it to yourself to do that. They were both Catholic and yet were able to survive in her court. Now, how could that occur?
Well, the phrase that I use is a safe Catholic. In other words, a Catholic that Queen Elizabeth believed wasn't actually plotting against her, that wasn't a political threat to her own power. William Byrd, we know, was a recovering Catholic, so was his wife, and yet he was allowed to retain a job in the Queen's court as the gentleman of the Chapel Royal, and as you rightly say, composed some of the most wonderful church music, and secretly continued to compose Catholic masses, as well as the official stuff he composed for Queen Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is that although some Catholic historians have sort of claimed that Shakespeare's Catholicism was secret, I say it wasn't secret, or at least it was an open secret, that people knew, and what Shakespeare had to do was to make sure that his Catholicism wasn't expressed in his plays or in his life in such a way that he could be considered to be a threat to the Queen, because at that point, then the law would come down on him. So he was walking a tightrope. And so much of the tension that we see in Shakespeare's plays is the tension of this tightrope. How does one walk on this tightrope, being true to one's conscience, by being true to one's faith, without expressing oneself in such a way that one's going to have the might of the Elizabethan law come down on one? And that's the problem that Shakespeare was facing, and that's the problem which Shakespeare's genius solved in the Catholic dimension of his play.
Yeah, it's just incredible when you really go to contemplate that, and that, I mean, I remember watching a year or two ago on the illustrious PBS, when I think it was at Nova, that ran a special trying to even discount the fact that William Shakespeare wrote his own plays. They lifted up Christopher Marlowe.
Christopher Marlowe's plays are certainly not as good as Shakespeare's, but he's a significant playwright. But I think he was a very troubled man and
mm-hmm.
almost certainly a spy who... whether or not his conversion to Catholicism was genuine, he certainly betrayed Catholics to the authorities.
Mm-hmm.
So, and died a violent death by basically, I think, and I argue in my book, died a violent death at the hands of his fellow spies, because I think he wanted out of the spy network. If you look at his play, Dr. Faust, this is clear. This is the man whose conscience is torturing him, and I think he wanted to get out of the sordid spy business. And the trouble, of course, when you're in that business is you know too much, and you know, if you get out, you could then start spilling the beans. So I think he was killed. He died in very, very, very suspicious circumstances. Long since been believed that there was foul play. And so, again, it's very likely that Christopher Marlowe knew Shakespeare, and, you know, I feel sorry for Christopher Marlowe. He was one of these people that was caught up in the spy network. For all I know, he was blackmailed, and they're difficult times, and the pure of heart maybe survive, but everybody else gets sucked into the sordidness, and Christopher Marlowe was one such person.
It is, again, very interesting how you go about really breaking that all open and giving the authenticity to Shakespeare as indeed the person who penned his plays, because there was a strong case for a while, wasn't there, that even Francis Bacon was the one that was indeed the...
There have been various fashions. 100 years ago, the so-called Baconians believed that Francis Bacon wrote the plays and Shakespeare didn't. And then, as you say, there's the school of thought that Christopher Marlowe wrote the plays, and now one of the most popular modern theories is that the Earl of Oxford wrote the plays. But what I show in my opening chapter, "Will the Real William Shakespeare Please Stand Up," mm-hmm. is that there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever for any of these theories, and that they're all based. It's like a house of cards, basically. They're all based on the fact that it couldn't have been William Shakespeare that wrote them, therefore it must have been someone else. And all you have to do is to demolish the argument that it couldn't have been William Shakespeare, and the rest of the edifice just comes tumbling down. So, you know, they claim he was too young, and I show that, you know, the great sonnets of the English language have been written by people who are the same age as Shakespeare was when he wrote his sonnets. They say that he was the son of illiterate peasants, and I show that, no, he wasn't. He was the son of the mayor of Stratford-upon-Avon, who was educated at the Stratford Grammar School, and the quality of that education was superb. So in other words, the arguments they use against William Shakespeare being the author of the plays can be demolished with relative ease. So I begin my book by showing that William Shakespeare was indeed William Shakespeare.
Also, for so many of those particular arguments, as you said, they would say his education is lacking. But you even demonstrate, or speculate at least, about his travels in Europe as a younger man, giving him experiences possibly even with the Jesuits in Rome.
Yeah, it's possible, because there's a period that's known as the Lost Years, where we don't really know where Shakespeare was, and that leaves us open to speculation. I say that he could have gone to Douay, the Catholic college in Douay, where priests were trained. He could have been studied there. He could have studied at the English college in Rome, all of which had been opened while he was a youth. So that's possible. I actually in my book, however, tend to think it more likely that he received his education at Stratford Grammar School, where I show that the evidence shows the vast majority of his teachers there were Catholics, and some of whom left the country. One of whom became a priest. Another of whom's brother was martyred as a priest. So even if he didn't go abroad for his education, even if he'd stayed at home at Stratford upon Avon, he would have had a profoundly, first of all, a good education and a Catholic education.
I don't think I appreciated the degree of persecution and martyrdom that occurred in England. I knew of it, but until I read your book, I didn't really grasp how horrific this period was. I mean, when you read the stories of the tortures that they would go through, I mean, with Braveheart, you got a sense of it with William Wallace, but when you read about, even in that what should have been a sophisticated period, a disemboweling and why the person's still alive because of their faith.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolute barbarism, and they refined the most hideous forms of torture. So someone such as St. Robert Southwell, for instance, was arrested in 1592 and was tortured repeatedly for a period of 3 years in various torture chambers in various prisons before finally being hanged, drawn, and quartered, which, as you say, was a hideously slow and barbaric way of killing someone, where you hang them, but pull them down, bring them down while they're still alive and still conscious, and then you disembowel them while they're still alive and plate them while they're still alive, and then finally, obviously after they're dead, you cut their head off, and then cut their dead body into four parts and stick the body parts up around the city walls to warn other people against doing the same thing. In other words, becoming a Jesuit priest in this case. Hideous barbarism, and the English, people forget, the English had endured 200 years of this persecution to finally, you know, turn England into a Protestant country. It took 200 years of vindictive persecution. And to me, the great heroes of this struggle, the 40 canonized martyrs of England and Wales, the 85 beatified martyrs of England and Wales, the countless others who have not been officially recognized by the church, and the recusant families, the defiant Catholic families who stayed loyal to the faith through 200 years of persecution. These are the true English heroes, as far as I'm concerned. But as an Englishman, this is the true England, and the England that inspires me.
Even after Elizabeth's death, there must have been some type of a hope in the hearts of those Catholics after she finally passed on and King James comes forward, the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, the husband of, what was it, Queen Anne? She was a Catholic. Yeah. That somehow their lives would be better, but yet that was not the case.
No, and if you look at the evidence of Shakespeare's Catholicism, we can see it in the history of this, because the play that he wrote around the time that James came to the throne was Measure for Measure, which is his most overtly Catholic play. And it's quite clear that the Catholics, when James came to the throne, there was a sense of euphoria and elation, because they thought at long last, after sort of the 40 or so years of Queen Elizabeth's reign, that the persecution would be lifted and they would be free to worship in accordance with their conscience. And for a year or so, King James showed signs that that indeed was what he hoped to do. But by this time, already the Puritans were very powerful in Parliament, and they were having none of it, and they basically already flexed their muscles and showed that they were more powerful than the king. And so we had this new period of persecution, which at which point the Catholics were really thrown into a period of darkness, because having had all their hopes raised, they were dashed again with a new king who was continuing with the persecution. And so what follows then are some of Shakespeare's darkest plays. You know, Macbeth and King Lear and Othello were all published, all written around this time when the Catholics, to their horror, realize that there's going to be no let-up in the persecution under the reign of King James.
Yeah, a very sad time. And in particular, this, for some of you out there listening, this is also around the time of the Gunpowder Plot. And anti-Catholicism, I think, has hit its peak, and it's still in its stride in so many ways because of that particular situation.
Absolutely. 1605 was the Gunpowder Plot, and that was an example of Catholics being driven to despair. And that plot, we know, was largely instigated by King James's spy network. They had plants involved all the time, which is why it was, the plot was discovered right at the key moment they were caught red-handed, because the whole thing was infiltrated by spies. But nonetheless, there was a real sense of Catholic despair and desolation in forcing some Catholics, the more hot-headed Catholics, to want to actually destroy Parliament as a way of ending the persecution. And that sort of sense of despair and desolation we see present in the darkness of Shakespeare's plays at that time.
And I think it bears note that Shakespeare's family continued to remain Catholic. His daughter, Susanna, well known. Am I correct in that?
Yes. She was actually fined for her recusancy in 1606, a year after the Gunpowder Plot was discovered, right at the height of the new persecution. I should explain, perhaps, that recusancy was the most defiant and devout Catholics refused to attend Anglican services, which the law said you had to do, and pay fines, heavy fines, for not attending in conscience, because as Catholics they believed that it was sinful to do so. So the recusant families were the most devout and defiant Catholic families. So the fact that William Shakespeare's father was fined in 1592 as a recusant, and the fact that his daughter, Susanna, was fined in 1606 as a recusant, you know, shows that Shakespeare's family wasn't just Catholic, it was militantly, defiantly Catholic to a degree that they were prepared to break the law and suffer the consequences.
Yeah, it changes how you read the plays. Ever since the conversation began, for me, I mean, this awakening of Shakespeare's Catholicism, it has definitely changed how I've read him. I remember in college having to read him, and I thought, this is rather dry, and he didn't really speak to me. But with this new lens, it changes everything, and it gives it such a depth.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you're looking for the relevance of it, obviously one of the things about Catholicism is it's timeless, that the moral lessons that you get from a Catholic perspective live across the centuries are undiminished. But what Shakespeare is dealing with here is the new Machiavellianism, the new secular fundamentalism. If you look at Shakespeare's plays and the morality, the heroes and the heroines are traditional Christians who have traditional Catholic virtue against the new unscrupulous secularism that puts the power of the world and worldliness over moral considerations. So you look at Shakespeare's villains and you get these Machiavels. And of course, what it means is the dialectic that's going on in Shakespeare's plays is something which is very relevant today between those who are saying we have to live our lives, have to conduct our politics according to timeless Christian virtue, against those who believe that it's all about power, it's all about doing what we want to do ourselves rather than what we should do morally. So the battle between Catholicism and Christianity on one side and secularism on the other, which is, of course, the very struggle that we find ourselves in the midst of now, mm-hmm. exactly what Shakespeare found himself in the midst of 400 years ago and that he's addressing in his plays. So the plays are very timely, very relevant to what's happening in the world today.
I love it. And yeah. He wasn't just some hapless romantic. I mean, I'm sure that there is an element of the passion for life that you always read in Shakespeare's plays, but yet this is just phenomenal. I cannot wait to the new book. I mean, you're going to get that done right away, right?
Yeah, well, actually, the good news is that the EWTN are turning this book, The Quest for Shakespeare, into a 13-part series.
Oh, right.
So we filmed that already, and that's going to be broadcast, I think, next March.
Excellent.
But they've also already given me the go-ahead to turn this second book into a second 13-part series, which we'll be filming in February. So the good thing about that, but also the bad thing about that, is that I have to have this book finished by August so that I can turn it into a TV script before I go back down to Ave Maria and start teaching in the fall. So it's really put the pressure on me. So it's not been great for the stress levels in my life. But the good thing about it will force me to get this book finished quickly.
If there's anybody that can handle it, it would be you, Joseph.
Well, thank you.
I cannot wait. I cannot highly recommend The Quest for Shakespeare more to everyone out there listening. Again, it is more than just a literature book, though you'll get literary criticism and understand literary characters so much better. It's more than a detective book. It's more than a history book. I mean, it is phenomenal. Hats off to you. I've read all of your work, Joseph. This one, I keep going back over and over again.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Seriously, it's very encouraging to hear that from someone, you know, that's appreciated other books, to know that the new book is up there, because, you know, one wants to keep up, you know, high standards and not to compromise standards because one's being pressured or whatever. So it's very reassuring for me to hear that from a discerning reader, and I know, Chris, that you are indeed a discerning reader.
Well, you can always tell when someone is truly in love with their subject and they're enjoying what they're doing, because for you, when you have that feeling, Joseph, it translates onto the paper, and it's infectious.
Well, thank you. I think enthusiasm and passion is infectious, and there's no doubt at all that I have a great enthusiasm and passion for the things I write about. So if that comes across, if that is indeed infectious, then I'm doing my job. That's great.
It makes me want to hop on a plane and get over to England and visit these places.
But it's much safer to be a Catholic in England now than it was 400 years ago.
How about that? And isn't it odd that even today, a prime minister would have to wait until he left office to be brought into the church, and that the princes still cannot marry a Catholic girl?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, one of the heirs to the throne is the son of the Duchess of Kent, recently married a Catholic and had to relinquish his right to the throne in order to do so. Mm. So that marriage happened within the last 2 years. So, you know, if this is a hangover of those years of persecution, and, you know, if there's any suggestion that someone couldn't marry a Muslim because of that, everyone would be up in arms.
Mm-hmm.
But, it seems that, you know, Catholicism is still okay to be a be a racist where Catholics are concerned.
It's been great talking with Joseph Pierce this morning. The book, The Quest for Shakespeare, The Bard of Avon, and The Church of Rome. Available, by the way, through Ignatius Press, too. So those of you listening may want to jump on Ignatius.com and track down The Quest for Shakespeare, Joseph Pierce. Joseph, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Any final thoughts or observations as we wrap up our all-too-brief time here together?
Well, no, except to thank you for having me on your show again. I'm genuinely thrilled when I hear that you want me on your show, because I know that the quality of questions are going to be good, and it allows me to actually engage the topic rather than just dealing with superficialities. So thank you very much for having me. It's been a great pleasure as always.
Well, I know the pressure's on, but keep writing.
That's right.
We can't have too many of your works out there.
Thank you.
All right, Joseph, we appreciate it. God bless.